In the previous episode of Why Work, Sib Sibanda and Paul Kim discussed Dorothy Sayers' first proposition, that work is what we were created to do, not just something we have to do. In this episode, they explore its implications for integrating work and rest, and taking pride in producing quality work.
Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique contexts on the African continent.
Hello and welcome to part three of the Why Work podcast series based on Dorothy Sayers' essay by the same title. Paul, you ready to get stuck in?
Yeah, it's been a fun two episodes so far and I'm looking forward to the next one. But before we get into this episode, I have some residual thoughts that I wanted to share with our audience from the first two episodes. The first is that because her proposition is to really, for lack of a better phrase, immerse ourselves in our work, the question of asking what work needs to be done is therefore unbelievably critical. Because once you're in it, you're fully immersed in it and you almost can't pull the brakes. And so this question of what work should be done is really important to get right from day one. Then the section on remuneration that we did, what I kind of failed to mention, and I wanted to mention it then, is this idea of being firstly underpaid. I think many of us feel like we're underpaid for the work that we've done. But the opposite of that must also be true, is that some jobs for some people in this day and age, given where we are and given what the culture values at the moment, you can be overpaid. And how many of us are willing to acknowledge that maybe because of a scarcity of skills more than anything else, we're getting paid too much? If you are a YouTuber today making millions, if you were born two centuries ago, you wouldn't have a job. And so a lot of this remuneration is actually hyper-contextual, and we're very happy to claim underpayment, but how many of us are willing to deal with overpayment? And then thirdly, a lot of work is not great. And I don't want us to gloss over that. Work can be done incorrectly or structured incorrectly. So I think of mundane work, repetitive, boring, click here, click there, no real creativity allowed. And in a lot of workplaces, I think, you know, you're forced to continue to maintain the status quo. You're not allowed to improve things. And I think that's where the real work is, in being given the ability to continue to improve and innovate. And many of us are shackled from doing that. So as we talk about this, I don't want the audience to think that we're glossing over the fact that work in this world is really painful at times.
Yeah, and that is one of the challenges of a podcast series like this, especially with an essay that's so rich in content, is that there's so much that we can't say, so much that we have to leave out. And that's why we're really keen for our audience to join in the conversation. Just send me your comments and questions on sibs@mergon.co.za. And we'll try in the final session to address some of those. Okay, so let's crack on with today's session. So in our previous session, we got to work on the first of Sayers' three propositions, which is that work is not a thing one does to live, but a thing one lives to do. We explored the first two implications that she draws from that proposition. The first one is concerning the way we think about remuneration, as you've just touched on, Paul. And the second, a challenge to pay more attention to our God-given gifts and passion in our career choices, and not just to think about how much money am I going to make from this. So this week, we're going to look at the last two implications. So she had four. We looked at the first two. This week, we're going to look at the last two implications that she draws from her first proposition, which have to do, firstly, with the way we think about rest, and secondly, the importance of taking pride in our work. And as always, let's start with the reading.
What is the Christian understanding of work? I should like to put before you two or three propositions arising out of the doctrinal position which I stated at the beginning, namely, that work is the natural exercise and function of man, the creature who is made in the image of his Creator. It is, or it should be, the full expression of the worker's faculties, the thing in which he finds spiritual, mental, and bodily satisfaction, and the medium in which he offers himself to God. Now, the consequences of this are not merely that the work should be performed under decent living and working conditions. That is a point we have begun to grasp, and it is a perfectly sound point. But we have tended to concentrate on it to the exclusion of other considerations far more revolutionary. A third consequence is that if we really believed this proposition and arranged our work and our standard of values accordingly, we should no longer think of work as something that we hasten to get through in order to enjoy our leisure. We should look on our leisure as the period of changed rhythm that refreshed us for the delightful purpose of getting on with our work. And this being so, we should tolerate no regulations of any sort that prevented us from working as long and as well as our enjoyment of work demanded. We should resent any such restrictions as a monstrous interference with the liberty of the subject. How great an upheaval of our ideas that would mean, I leave you to imagine. It would turn topsy-turvy all our notions about hours of work, rates of work, unfair competition, and all the rest of it. We should find ourselves fighting, as now only artists and the members of certain professions fight, for precious time in which to get on with the job, instead of fighting for precious hours saved from the job. A fourth consequence is that we should fight tooth and nail, not for mere employment, but for the quality of the work that we had to do. We should clamour to be engaged in work that was worth doing and in which we could take pride. The worker would demand that the stuff he helped to turn out should be good stuff. He would no longer be content to take the cash and let the credit go. Like the shareholders in the brewery, he would feel a sense of personal responsibility and clamour to know and to control what went into the beer he brewed. There would be protests and strikes, not only about pay and conditions, but about the quality of the work demanded and the honesty, beauty, and usefulness of the goods produced. The greatest insult which a commercial age has offered to the worker has been to rob him of all interest in the end product of the work and to force him to dedicate his life to making badly things which were not worth making.
Okay, so the third implication has to do with rest and rhythm in our work. And I know it's a topic you're quite fond of, Paul. We did go into it in some detail in the Monday Christian series, so I'm really keen to hear what you have to say. So we touched on the theological basis for rest last week, Paul, noting that in Genesis 2:2, God rested from his work of creation. And really, that's generally how we tend to think about rest, isn't it? That we rest from our work. So we've worked all week, and now we rest from that work at the weekend or on holidays. But says here is bringing out a fascinating perspective, which is that our approach to rest mustn't only be retrospective, whereby it's merely a means of recovering from the week or from the work that we've already done, but that we should also look at it prospectively. In other words, where it's a means of preparation for work yet to be done. That's a refreshing perspective, don't you think?
Yeah, Sibs, I think it was new to me. I was always a big advocate of a work-rest rhythm, Sabbath being the name for rest, as we find in Genesis 2 and other scriptures where it's referenced that way. But this idea of then the rest being connected to the work that is ahead is absolutely beautiful. And what it does is it's no longer work-rest, that cycle, and then a reset, and then another work rest cycle. It kind of connects all the cycles together. And it's just, yeah, it's a very refreshing way of looking at work rest rhythms. But the point I want to maybe start off with is to say that I think as much as we'd like for people, as much as we'd like to think that people rest, I don't think that is true anymore for many of us. Rest is no longer rest, it's entertainment. And part of that, I think, is a function of broken work. Because we don't get joy from our work, we kind of scramble to get joy elsewhere. And so when we are off work, whether it's in the evenings or the weekends, it's jam-packed, full of activities to entertain ourselves, whether it's digitally driven or sports activities or laser quest, whatever it is, we end up doing a lot of activities to get our enjoyment in. And that often doesn't leave us in a good place from a rest perspective. Because yes, we've had a lot of leisure and entertainment, but to Sayer's point, it doesn't rest us for the week ahead. So in the Monday Christians mini-series on rest, we made the proposal that it's not so much a work-life balance, but rather work-life integration or work-rest rhythms. And I think what she's pointing to is very similar. She's advocating for work-rest integration and rest-work integration, the latter of which is what we're digesting now. And the more I think about it, she must be right. It's the logical, natural conclusion of a work that is meaningfully fulfilling, that has God and love of never at its center. Why would you restrain that if that is the purpose of your work? The only restraint that is worthy is one that allows you to do more of it and at a better quality in the future, which is then what the rest is. Rest, as in the definition she uses, is there to help you prepare for the work ahead. But another thought on leisure specifically. As a thought experiment, let's assume for a second that leisure was at the center of our lives. What would our lives look like if that was the case? If leisure was the primary purpose of life, there would be a massive disconnect between work and leisure, because what you did for work would be completely irrelevant to your leisure as long as you had enough time, money, etc. to enjoy your leisure. Also, if leisure is at the center, it will most likely be less about rest than it is about entertainment, because humans are not designed, nor are they built to have non-activity at the core of their lives. So anyway, so those are some of the scattered thoughts that I had on this topic. But in terms of her proposal that rest should be done in anticipation of the work ahead, I think for us, it's very difficult to gauge that as knowledge workers. And so the example I thought of is as an athlete. To be a top athlete in any discipline takes an incredible amount of work. What can be taken for granted is that peak performance must be practiced at some point. So if you're a sprinter, at some point during your training, you are sprinting as fast as you can. But what many may not realize is the range of supporting activities required for optimal performance on competition or race day. So for those of you who may not be aware, it's things like activities at different levels of intensity. So playing, if you're a tennis player, playing a game of tennis with different levels of skill, different levels of intensity. You may also be breaking down the activity in subsets of skill and practicing those subsets. So specific shots, jogging, sprinting in order to increase your endurance, running on the court. It also includes supporting ancillary activities, things like stretching and recovery. You're definitely considering nutrition, hydration, and supplements. And these days, big match temperament, taking care of your mental acuity and preparedness is massive, because on game day, if you're not in the right frame of mind, it really affects your performance. Now, what I can guarantee you is, the topic is now rest, right? That they take their rest very seriously ahead of game time or game day. They don't do anything that's going to get in the way of their performance on game day. So you're not going to see them binging out on series the day before their finals match. And it's because they fully appreciate how those two are connected, the rest ahead of the work.
Make some interesting points there, Paul. I think the first one is this idea that we almost assume that weekends are for rest and that we are resting, but actually we are entertaining ourselves and often wearing ourselves out in doing that. And so it just begs the question, and I just wonder if we need to rethink how we approach our weekends. And I know for many of our listeners, you'll have kids and they have to be taken to rugby and soccer and all this and that. But I just think it's worth thinking, dwelling on that a little bit, and asking yourself, maybe yourself as an individual or as a couple, as a family, what does it mean to rest at the weekend and not just to entertain ourselves? But I want to just pick up on that hypothetical scenario you painted for us, where leisure is at the center of the human life and existence and not work, right? If you flip the script and we actually exist for leisure, because I think it has important implications for mental health conversation that we touched on last week. So just to set the stage, think about a typical week and the emotions and the thoughts that go through one's mind. Okay, so for your average Joe, let's start on Wednesday. So Wednesday typically is In my family group, we call it hump day because it's kind of the hump you need to get over in order to make your way to the weekend. And it's almost like the mountain peak from which you can see the promise of the weekend coming, right? And Thursday, in many senses, is really just a bridge. It's a bit of a nothing day. It's just the day before Friday, right? Let's just get through it and get to Friday. And then Friday, we start to get excited. We start to get happy because the weekend is coming, right? And we start to anticipate that. And Friday evening, normally we're in a very good mental, emotional state because the weekend's finally here. We've got Saturday coming. And Saturday is really the only day where you can lie in as late as you want and stay up for as long as you want and pretty much do what you want to do. And so that's a really good day. And then Sunday rolls around. And certainly for Christians, although technically Sunday is part of the weekend, you have to wake up and go to church. And for those with young kids like yourself, Paul, it's a bit of a production going to church on a Sunday morning. It's quite a lot of work. And then Sunday afternoon is a bit relaxed, but as the sun starts to set, so too does the mood, right? Because the dark clouds of Monday are sort of coming together. And I know I've talked to people who actually get depressed on Sunday evening just from the pure anticipation of Monday morning. And Monday morning rolls around and the alarm clock goes off and you wake up with a deep sigh as you carry kind of the weight of the next 5 days that are to come. So let's just think about this. You know, this entire mental and emotional cycle is based on that often subconscious presupposition that life is fundamentally about leisure, about resting, about having fun, about doing what we want. And as such, the kind of things that we like doing at the weekends and on holidays. And so with that view, work in between is a bit of a necessary evil, something we have to get through, something we need to plow through in order to get to what we really want to do, right? To enjoy our leisure. And if that's our view, then it's no wonder we're in a mental health crisis. Because if 5 days of the week are begrudging toil that we just need to get through in order to do the thing that we are really created to do or the thing we really want to do, then we're dead in the water, right? And just a silly example from the world of sports, you know, as we do this podcast, it's the World Cup is on, right? And South Africa, I believe, is playing tomorrow. Big match. And so imagine a rugby player who despises the game and just lives for halftime, right? So they go through the first 40 minutes and they don't really enjoy that, but they're looking forward to the halftime where they can sit down and eat oranges. You sort of think about that and think that doesn't really make sense. The whole point of playing sport is playing rugby, is enjoying the game. But yet, if we put leisure at the center of our lives and we see work as just begrudging toil, we're not too different from that guy. Don't you think just that simple change of perspective where we put work in its rightful place at the center could have a significant impact on mental health at work?
Yeah, Sips, 100%. I think most people don't realize that chasing after careers or jobs that pay the most, they are shortchanging themselves by potentially using out on the joy from work. And that is a gap that just can't be, or the itch that can't be scratched in any other way. And so I suspect many of us, if we were willing to take lower pay, but do something that's more suited to us and something that we would take more joy in, we would actually be much better off as humans. But, you know, our culture doesn't support that. We don't make the decisions that way. And therefore we end up in this rut where, but take a high-paying job, don't enjoy work, seek fulfillment in the weekends and the evenings, and rinse and repeat, and you get stuck in that very vicious cycle. So yeah, so I think, you know, it definitely has an impact on your mental health. To your point, 5 days out of seven doing work that doesn't fulfill you is a major issue, especially if Dorothy is right with some of her propositions. The one at the beginning of her essay is like really interesting. I asked that it should be looked upon not as a necessary drudgery to be undergone for the purpose of making money, but as a way of life in which the nature of man should find its proper exercise and delight, and so fulfill itself to the glory of God. So there's a part of our humanity that we can only unlock, or that we can't unlock in any other way other than through work. If we then assume that humans are created as holistic beings, where you cannot separate out the mental, physical, spiritual, emotional, etc., then we are going to take a major mental hit if our work itch is not scratched. Secondly, if you look for that itch elsewhere, it's not going to fulfill you in the same way. So not only do you only have 2 days out of the seven that you're quote unquote enjoying, it's also of the wrong nature. So it kind of leaves you hungry. And finally, and the triple whammy, is that you're supposed to be resting and you're not, which sets you up for a painful week ahead of you. Again, this idea of a vicious cycle coming in. Rinse and repeat for a couple of weeks, and then you see why people are so desperate for that holiday at the end of the year, or why people end up creating a long-term, low-grade friction that burns up our mental health. Burnout. So if you're not doing work that's fulfilling, and I'm not saying there's only a specific type of work that's fulfilling. You know, God has created a range of different work and a range of different workers. If you don't match it correctly, you're in for a miserable life.
Well, how do you feel on Sunday night?
So, Sips, that's a really good question. And I, for the most part, I enjoy my work. So I'm waiting in anticipation for the week ahead. But here's the trick. And this is where I think I differ from a lot of people. I don't like putting myself in a place where I'm stressing. So for me, I would rather spend a couple of hours on a Saturday morning or Sunday, depending on which day I want to take off, getting rid of my emails, preparing and cleaning my desk for the week. Because then when I wake up on Monday morning, I know a lot of the stuff has been dealt with and I can enter the week in peace. Now, a lot of people I know are quite rigid. No, you can't touch your work email over the weekend, but then they end up stressed on Monday morning. I'm like, why would you shoot yourself in the foot? Do whatever it takes to make sure that you enjoy your work.
I think you make a good point, right? Because it is easy to say, to become religious about these things and not actually think through what we're doing, implications thereof. So I think my knee-jerk reaction to you saying, sort of prior to the series, to you saying, oh, I clear emails on Saturday or whatever the case may be. But no, Paul, I'd counsel you. You shouldn't do that. You know, Saturday's for rest. You should be, you know. But with this view that actually you're asking the question at the weekend, how am I preparing for great work next week? Then for you, that might be a really good answer. And again, you know, no one is selling this as best practice or gospel, but I think it is just helpful by way of illustration to show how thinking about things the right way can order your life perhaps in surprising ways. Okay, so let's crack on now to the fourth and final implication of the first proposition, which states as follows: we should not be content to produce merely what we can sell for a profit, but engage in work that is worth doing and do it well. Protests and strikes will no longer be just for working conditions, but about the quality of work, the honesty, beauty, and usefulness of the goods produced, end quote. Now, I doubt that Sayers intended any humor in this statement, but just think about what she's saying here. And I now live in Zim, but I lived in South Africa for a long time. And one of my enduring memories of South Africa are protests and strikes and people dancing on the streets. Now, just picture that scene, and a reporter approaches one of the protesters and says, why are you protesting, you know, in front of this factory? And she says, well, we're protesting because we're tired of putting our name to poor quality products that harm the environment and encourage unhealthy lifestyles for the consumers. Right? I think we'd all think they'd gone mad, wouldn't we?
Yeah, it would be a really major surprise, but a positive one at that. And those are the types of strikes that I would be very much in support of and potentially join on the sidelines. Unfortunately, I think the way we've structured work in the world means that it's not possible to give employees the ability to let's call it put their name to their work. Long story short, I think we've structured the work in a way that disconnects the worker from the end result. And there's a couple of themes that, maybe we've pursued in the name of productivity but as a result have created these disconnects. So first is this thing about siloed work. We've structured work in many of these environments to be effectively done in silos. It makes it really difficult for someone to really appreciate their effect on the overall result. Siloed work, though seemingly productive, often creates unhealthy conditions for humans, mundane, repetitive working conditions that very easily can reduce the appreciation for honesty, beauty, and the usefulness of the goods produced. Secondly, consumers desiring cheap stuff that often translates to survival being of importance, which is then in friction with quality. I came across a very concerning documentary on the usage of sewage oil in a non-insignificant number of Chinese restaurants, and it was frightening. To make ends meet, they were using recycled oil, and they showed some snapshots of these Chinese workers transferring oil out of a garbage bin effectively in order to reduce costs. And, you know, I can't speak for all of the restaurants, but I'm assuming some of them must have done it in order to stay in business. So how often are we as consumers a big part of the problem, that we just look at price as the only reason for buying something and continue to demand a price that actually is unsustainable and creates unbelievably terrifying working conditions? And then this idea of a name, it's quite interesting because we often think about wanting to have a name as a bad thing. But I think in this case, we need to have a little bit of a different perspective. You know, typically the people associated with a company that get the name are the top executives and no one else. If you're thinking about a name, wanting a name for yourself within a corporate, it's typically not associated with the product or the end result. It's to further your career. It's to climb the ranks. And that's what it means to pursue a name. I think it's very rare that we see a name being sought in relation to the end product. And it's often the reserve of the artisan or the artist. A fascinating example from the world of motoring, the Nissan GT-R or the Mercedes AMG. There, the engines that are built, the engineer that built the engine, hand-built the engine, gets to put their name on a plate that's attached to the engine. And that's a really cool example of what it means to put your name to the product. Perhaps just to say an example that's quite close to home at the moment for me, which is a company that I'm working at called PeopleFlow. And we're looking at, you know, how do you redesign the work there so that it's not mundane and monotonous and always firefighting? And so we've turned the support function into, or we've given it a different name. Firstly, it's client success, not client support. And the mandate is far reaching. It's not just about being reactive to issues on the ground. They have the full mandate to be proactive, to take the time to educate the customer, to help them implement, full autonomy in that regard. And not only that, they have a seat at the table when it comes to product decisions. So they're dealing with a lot of crap down the road. They get to take it up and say, guys, we're going to change the prioritization because the way it's currently being done is creating a mess down the road, and we get to dictate how that changes. And so that's just one small example from the world of technology as it relates to support. And I think siloed work has unfortunately done a lot of bad for a lot of workers. And if you start closing the gaps in the way that we're attempting to, you'll see a lot more enjoyment in the workplace, which is what we've experienced, giving more autonomy and agency to fix their own issues instead of always being the recipient of problems has been very healthy for us.
Mm. You make some good points there, Paul. But I'm just wondering, are we sounding a bit naive, right? In the sense that, yes, it would be great for people to take pride in their work. Yeah, it would be great if people could sign, you know, the engines that they made off a Toyota Yaris. Yes, it would be great if everybody felt that they were making a valuable contribution and they were involved in not just mundane work, but had maybe broader responsibilities, you know, that made them feel more engaged and more fulfilled. And all of this sounds very wonderful and kumbaya, but is this realistic, right? Because in the world that we live in, there is increasing pressure towards efficiency and cost cutting. And whether that's coming from growing shareholder expectations or increasing consumerism of the West that is demanding cheaper products and more of them, or in our context where you're looking more at practical considerations of affordability, right? If your goods and services are not cheap, people can't afford them, simple as that. And in order to make them cheap or affordable, there's certain sacrifices that have to be made, which as far as goods and services are concerned, is emphasizing volume over quality. And as far as the workers themselves are concerned, is emphasizing productivity than any sense of pride in one's work. So how then can we think and act redemptively, yet practically, given this economic reality?
Yeah, that's my biggest fear with a lot of what we're doing, services, that we have the luxury of, you know, engaging theoretically on a topic, which often can sound very divorced from reality. And this is, you've hit the nail on the head here. Like, the world is a really tough place to be in at the moment, very competitive, and survival being a key issue. But to your point, I think it starts off with every person thinking of themselves as a consumer first, because if we're not going to change our consumption habits, really, businesses are at the mercy of their consumers. And if you want to change your business, well, the starting point is for you to change your habits as a consumer. And it's maybe two key ideas to consider. Sometimes non-consumption is the right thing. If you can't afford to drink a wine 4 times a month, because you know, the starting point for a decent quality wine that looks after their farm work as well is only affords you to drink it twice a month, then you should probably just drink it twice a month. No one says you've got to drink it 4 times a month. Non-consumption in the pursuit of quality and sustainability is a very healthy way of looking at consumption. And then secondly, repairing. I think I made the comment in the first episode. Like, we've got to pursue repairing of things as a real way of living life, instead of making the convenient and easy option of just throwing it away and buying the next thing. So that's just as a, you know, two interesting points as it relates to consumption. But moving over into the world of business, look, a lot of this is North Star. It's where we want to move toward. And given, you know, where you are at the point, this point in time, there's a journey that needs to be undertaken. There's a very interesting, let's call it, warning from Sri Lanka. I know they had a whole bunch of other issues, corruption, nepotism, and all of that. But they decided to move over to organic agriculture production almost overnight, and it decimated their economy. And that's a, you know, a big warning to the rest of us, even in our day to day. There is a North Star. Let's move towards it. Let's be wise as we make the transition. It's not a moralistic issue. A lot of this is wisdom applied day to day as we move to that which we know is right. And then to be a little bit more practical, first thing I wanted to say is, guys, if we keep doing the same things in order to expect different results, then we're the crazy ones, right? We know how the current story plays out. It's not good on our workers. It's not good on us. It's not good on our businesses. So at some point, we've got to admit that and say, well, whatever we do, we can't continue to support the status quo. Well, then you've got to look for an alternative. And this is where kind of renewing of one's mind, if you're a Christian, becomes critical. Redemptive imagination allows you, or allows us, to look at a broken context and with the Holy Spirit, be able to see a new way of doing things. Innovation in light of God's kingdom being possible, instead of being shackled by the way the world thinks about a specific industry or a way of doing business. And it's being able to seek that and start off in that area, because if we can't imagine a different way of doing life, then it's not going to flow into the way we are actually doing life. And so just a different perspective often allows us to see solutions that typically wouldn't be possible. And then finally, you know, the one thing I come across quite often in my circle are these hidden assumptions about lifestyle, like what I am supposed to be living at. I think Dorothy says high standard of living, if I remember correctly from her essay. That often shackles us from being able to be innovative and to do what's right for the business. So if you've got a small business, two blue collar workers, and you're pulling 100K and they're pulling 4K, that's probably not right for the business nor for the workers, right? And it's artificial, because why should you be pulling 100K other than you demanding it for your lifestyle? It's got nothing to do with the business dynamics. Should that business, irrespective of whether you're involved in it or not, be paying 100K a month for that role? And the answer is probably no if you only have two blue collar workers.
Thanks, Paul, for those insights. I was just thinking as you were talking, I think it's an important point you brought up about this being a journey, right? Because on the one hand, you could listen to this conversation and think, oh, that's just naive, right? That won't work, right? And switch off and carry on the way you were. But again, going back to the biblical Christian worldview, so the lens through which we engage and interpret reality, right? Creation, God made everything and it was good. Fall means that everything that God created was corrupted. But redemption means we're not just saved, but we become co-laborers and agents of redemption. And in his book, Every Good Endeavor, Tim Keller makes quite a helpful observation where he says the reality of living in this dispensation where sin has corrupted everything God created is that we must avoid two errors. The first one is idealism, right? So the thinking that, oh, okay, this is how things should be, therefore that's just how things are going to be, right? And I am going to make them like that no matter what, okay? Because that's just not realistic. You are underplaying the impact of sin. But the other side of the horse that we can fall off, which he warns us against, is cynicism. Okay? So cynicism says, there's no point. What's the use, right? The world is corrupt. South Africa's corrupt. Africa's corrupt. And you can't do anything except this way. So what's the point of even trying? And so as redemptive leaders, we're walking that line where we are neither being naive and overly idealistic, but at the same time are not just giving up, throwing up our hands in the air and saying, well, there's just nothing we can do. This is just how things are. So I think that was a very helpful comment for our listeners as we carry on processing these things. Paul, we're going to land the episode. I wonder if you have any final thoughts that you'd like to put in.
Yeah, I want to end off by reflecting on a quote from her essay, one that often isn't quoted, and it goes as follows. No nation has yet found a way to keep the machines running and whole nations employed under modern industrial conditions without wasteful consumption. And remember, this was written during wartime, World War II. Where we are in world economic history increases the value of Dorothy's essay, because more than 50 years later, with many different economic experiments to review, her comment seems to remain valid. If you look at the economic models we have deployed across the globe, I'm not sure that you can find many, if any at all, that over time has proven to be that which creates prosperity for all stakeholders within a nation. So as revolutionary as her ideas sound, as crazy as they sound, and I'm still grappling with some of the practical implications of them, but what's crazier is for us to keep doing the same thing and expecting different results. Perhaps it's time that we take God's word seriously, and perhaps the first chapter of God's word was remarkably prescient and more foundational than just a response to evolution. Maybe Genesis 1 and 2 should be seen as God's original design and intent for creation, and along with that, our operating mandate as humans. As Christians who believe that God created everything and communicates us with primarily through his word, we shouldn't be surprised that the answers to life's most challenging questions were hidden in plain sight to begin with. And in closing, just a favorite Proverbs verse, I think I use it once every second or third episode we shoot. It is the glory of God to conceal things, but the glory of kings is to search it out. And I think we need to take on our mandate as kings and to search out the things that God has hidden in creation for us to uncover and use for the benefit of all.
Okay, thanks, Paul, for those great ideas, and hopefully we can develop those in the following sessions. But for today, that's a wrap. Quick reminder to our listeners of that email to send your comments and questions to sibs@mergon.co.za. Thank you for listening in. We'll catch you in the next session, where we'll move on to Sarah's second proposition. God bless.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Ziwani is a Mergon initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.